then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I've heard orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be, in the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One more bore for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, with your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud wall cabin eyes were watching through the night. Many a man big chest was throbbing for the blessed warning light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the man she's lonely crew, and the thousand blades were flushing at the rising of the moon. At the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest homeland, comrades. It's October the 11th, 2012. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest. Yeah, I've finally decided to let the 1914 bit go, not just because it was wearing a bit thin, but because, in my opinion, right now, there is a better than 50% chance that Benjamin Netanyahu is not going to attack Persia before the elections. That's elections plural, both in this country and in Israel. Israel uses a European-style proportional representation system of the kind that we really need to adopt in America if the power structure really wants to prevent civil war, but which ain't ever going to happen because it allows for multiple parties, not just two, and we can't have that now, can we? Anyway, this system allows the prime minister to dissolve the legislature, which in Israel is called the Knesset, and call new elections whenever he wants within a five-year period, which Netanyahu has just done. And that gives us at least a month before he launches his bombers, if then. Even Netanyahu isn't nutty enough to start a war, which will mean voters have to go to the polls with Katyusha rockets raining down on them from Lebanon and Gaza. I suppose it's always possible that many months of Benny waving his saber aloft like a hysterical lunatic may have frightened enough Jews over there so that they'll remove him from power. In which case, that would most likely mean that the powers that be in the world have decided that a war against Persia would be too costly to their own interests, and so they've put Israel on a leash, and they've decided to allow the Persians to have a few nuclear power plants, which has some very interesting geopolitical implications indeed. Now let's just see how that one plays out. Now, over here in this country, I am observing another interesting phenomenon in all the electoral sound and fury. Now, I don't want to start sounding like Rush Limbaugh, who has spent weeks on his show ranting and raving about how the liberal Democrats are cooking the polls in favor of Obama to make it look like Barry's way ahead and his re-election's assured. I mean, Jesus, they're Democrats. Of course they're cheating. But something strange has been happening for the past week. Now, all of a sudden, there has been an almost complete reversal in all the polls, and Mitt Romney is now the favored winner. Ostensibly, this was because that stupid high yellow Barry screwed up the first presidential debate so badly, which he did. As far as I'm concerned, that debate only proves something that we already know, and that's that Barry literally can't carry on a simple conversation without his teleprompter, without some Jew like David Axelrod or Cass Sunstein hiding behind the curtain telling him what to say. Look, I think everybody in America by now realizes that not only is Barack Hussein Obama not the sharpest knife in the drawer, he isn't even a knife, he's a wooden spoon, if you follow my analogy. But what makes me curious is why all of a sudden the Jewish and liberal-controlled mainstream media, which up until now has been totally under the control of the Democrats to the degree that they're not even reporters anymore, they're just stenographers taking dictation from the regime. Now, why is the media all of a sudden publishing polls that seem to be much more reflective of the American reality than almost anything they've allowed past the censorship over the past 4 years? Could it just be, that the actual power structure in this country, the faceless men, both Jew and Gentile, in the expensive business suits who actually exercise control and make policy and decide who gets what and who does what to whom, Could it just be that the for real shakers and movers in American society have decided at the last moment to change horses in midstream and dump Barack Obama? Could there have been some kind of quiet, invisible power struggle inside the establishment between the ultra-Zionist Jews and neoconservatives, represented by Romney and Dick Cheney and Karl Rove, and the old-line 60s retread Marxists, represented by Hillary Clinton and the old lefties of the Obama faction, a power struggle that maybe the ultra-Zionists and neocons won? And now the mainstream media does a 180, and all of a sudden the ultimate Jew ass-kisser Mitt Romney is the front-runner for president. Was that the deal that Netanyahu made with the faceless men behind the curtain when he came to this country a few weeks ago? His price for not attacking Persia now and starting World War III during an American election October was to get this uppity nigger who wouldn't even meet with him fired, and get Israel's catamite Mitt Romney into the Oval Office so the war can begin in January or February. I don't know, but between these two events, I definitely smell a backroom deal of some kind cooking here. I think we're in for a very interesting 4 weeks. Okay, got an email. Dear HAC, would you share your thoughts on the Greek Nationalist Party Golden Dawn? While they've gained seats in Parliament, they seem very much to be primarily political soldiers. What are your thoughts on the party, media portrayal of the Golden Dawn, and what can we learn from them? Sincerely yours, Lights. Yes, that's the guy's name, Lights. And once again, I'm afraid I can't remember where Lights is from, so I apologize. Yes, I am familiar in a general way with the Golden Dawn. They've been around for about 30 years or so, and for many years they were a small fringe group like most of our outfits are, but because Greece is such a small country, and its Zionist puppet regime was never that strong, and because Greece was the first country where socialism light failed and the welfare state collapsed, they've been able to get a few people into parliament, although I expect that at some point the ruling Jews and leftists will simply outlaw them. That they have not done so far is probably because I understand Golden Dawn has a lot of police officers as members, and the Greek government realizes that when the country collapses completely, as it seems about to do, they are going to need the loyalty of their cops and their military. I also know that they rely a lot on traditional newspapers and leaflets because the Jews at Google and other worldwide providers keep shutting down their websites and internet accounts, so forth and so on. Again, Greece is a sufficiently small country so that they can do this. They also tend to be a lot more proactive than we are over here. I've seen videos of one of their leaders slapping around some leftist bitch on the floor of their parliament, and a group of about 50 Golden Dawners attacking a flea market run by illegal nigger immigrants and smashing the place up and beating the crap out of the Kaffirs. Now, from what I know of them, Golden Dawn seems to be more fascist than racial or NS, and they just basically hate communists and non-white invaders of their country, which is all very well and good if you're a Greek. We're not Greeks, though. We're Americans. And our situation here is completely different. They can smash up illegal alien markets and smack red bitches in the face on TV because they have European men who still have some physical courage, and because their country is small enough so that they can concentrate those men into a manageable area and clench them like a fist. In this country, most of our people are kind of like comic book guy on The Simpsons, or sometimes like Barney Gumble and maybe Ned Flanders. And our country is so huge that on the increasingly rare occasions when any of us even try a street walk, people have to spend 2 days driving across 6 states in some old beater car to attend. There are so few of us, and we are so scattered across the whole vast continent. Now, you know what the solution is. God knows I have told you often enough. The first step is to reduce the problem to manageable proportions and to create communities of white nationalists and separatists, which will serve as a safety net and a support system for the countless thousands of white migrants who will be fleeing to the Northwest soon. Sooner than anybody thinks, I suspect. Europe is Europe. I wish our comrades there all the best, but their situation is different and they must find their own solutions. The solution here is for you to turn off your computer and go rent a U-Haul and start packing your stuff into it for the move northwest. Okay, got an audio clip this week from one of our local boys. Well, almost local. This is Chris from Montana.
Greetings, comrades. My name's Chris. I'm here to talk to you about the Northwest Imperative, particularly the Northwest Front. You know, there's a lot of different ideas, philosophies, and groups out there. And many of us adhere to what we call the movement. But I think that to actually call something a movement, it has to be moving. And movement's really not moving other than what we have here in the Northwest Front. You know, if you're listening to this podcast, then you obviously have the courage to at least listen. So why not have the courage to move here to the Northwest and be a part of this thing to save our great people? I'll give you a brief history of what brought me to the Northwest Front. In high school, I kind of noticed the tribal effect of different groups of people. I had a small crew, you could call it, of my friends. We more or less kind of banded together and had similar ideas. As we hit our, you know, early 20s, we decided to go our own ways. But there was a few of us that still stuck to certain beliefs that we here at the Northwest Front believe. I find it interesting, though, as I got older, I traveled. I went all over many different states, all over the West, the South, the Southwest, the Southeast, the Central, the Midwest. And whenever I came home, I realized that being from here, I always took it for granted, and I never quite understood the beauty and just what a special place the Northwest is. There were so many things that I didn't even quite understand, and I think a lot of Native people, woodchucks, you might call them, don't quite grasp and understand and take for granted because they've never lived in Chicago, they've never lived in Detroit. So that you see, you drop somebody in that element and you meet a lot of people that haven't done that and they're from here and they're going to jump on the liberal bandwagon. They're going to follow the PC terminology. They're going to, you know, whatever they soak up on TV. I unfortunately didn't find out about Harold Covington until about 2010. Our quote unquote movement is really good about shuffling people like Harold under the rug. You know, I was never a big movement person. I was kind of on the peripheral edges as I was busy working and whatnot. I had my ideas and knew right from wrong, but I look back and I look at his writings, you know, Dreaming the Iron Dream, The March Up Country, things like that. I'd wish that I'd found those books at a younger age. Yeah, I wish that there was the more of us possibly could have found that in my age group. But some people ask why. Why the Northwest? Why not stay here, stand and fight? And I say to you, what are you fighting for there? You're fighting for the same thing we're fighting for here. Except for here, we are surrounded by our own people. This is the last bastion of the white race. Other people, they want to push us out as the haters and evil Nazis and call us what you will. But I mean, all you have to simply do is look at the facts that our people will simply be nothing but history in a century if we keep going at the rate we're at. We need a homeland. We have to have a homeland. And it's an idea that has to come to fruition. We have simply stated in our white book what it takes. The plan is simple. You know, I could sit here all day and talk about the Fed, Zog, CFR, 9/11, Oklahoma City, Waco, Ruby Ridge, Edgar Steele, Jewish ritual murder, the Patriot Act, and the list goes on and on and on. But none of that stuff really matters. What really matters is coming home to the Northwest, because that is what's going to make us a homeland. And from that comes a future. When you look at yourself in the mirror, when you look at your children, if you have children, or you look at your nephews and nieces, or you look at someone else's children, and you see that part of them that is carried on, and you realize that that is life, part of our life that carries on. And to have that future generation flow, you need ground. You need a place for it to prosper and to expand. And without having a place like that, you'll have nothing. You have death. You have imminent suicide. May you be someone that comes here with the shirt on your back, or may you be someone that has a U-Haul and a family with 8 or 9 kids. It's the same thing. It's simple. You come home. You get here. And otherwise, in another 4 years, hell, 2 years, you will be looking in that mirror and wondering, why didn't I do this? it's pretty obvious. It's pretty easy to tell what's going on and what's going to happen. I mean, they're blaming stuff on videos on YouTube for civil unrest in the Middle East. It's just absolutely insane. I don't understand why anybody could sit there and call themselves a white nationalist, someone that believes in the 14 words and would not want to actually do something for blood and soil, for children's generations, for the generations yet unborn. What will you do?
You know, one of these days, people are going to be making movies about us and about this period in our history. Yes, really, they will be. Now, this is a miscellaneous piece I got off another movie soundtrack, which I think might make a good opening theme for a documentary on the Northwest War of Independence. Maybe the opening scene for Freedom's Sons, if anybody ever makes a movie out of that. I'm sure you can imagine the opening credits of such a movie, made in the best docudrama style by PBS. Only during production, a few PBS Jews were found on the set with their noses and ears sliced off by the War Prevention Bureau, just to make sure that the producers and directors maintained proper balance in their presentation of our new nation's history. Still, imagine your descendants watching such a movie on a big plasma screen that fills a whole wall, with photos of NVA guerrillas and historical incidents during the Revolution, the Northwest War of Independence. And imagine that you're sitting there among your children and your grandchildren, and they're all looking at you out of the corner of their eyes because they know that you are a veteran of that war. Because they know that what they're seeing on their TV screen, you were there. In June of 2010, North Idaho attorney Edgar J. Steele was arrested by the FBI on false charges of allegedly hiring a hitman to murder his wife and mother-in-law. The alleged assassin was a man named Larry Fairfax, an FBI informer who had previously been inserted into Steele's home posing as a handyman to spy on the Steele family before any of this came up. While he was working there, Fairfax proceeded to help himself to large stashes of silver coins and bullion that the Steeles were keeping on their property in anticipation of a Federal Reserve currency crash brought about by Barack Obama's incompetence. The final whereabouts of that silver seems to be something of a mystery. Apparently, the FBI allowed Fairfax to keep at least some of it as a kind of bonus or reparations for the annoyance and inconvenience of having to spend 16 months in a minimum security prison in the service of the Bureau. The basis of Edgar Steele's conviction were audio files fabricated by FBI technicians, supposedly discussions between himself and Fairfax about murder for hire, which appeared even to a layman who first heard them to sound strained, stilted, unnatural, and obviously doctored at the key points and phrases. The Steele tapes were not only forgeries, apparently they weren't even very good ones. At Steele's trial, two international audio engineering experts who were prepared to testify that the tapes were fraudulent were barred from appearing in court by a corrupt judge. The jury was never allowed to hear evidence which clearly proved Edgar Steele's innocence. The situation wasn't helped by the fact that Steele's first attorney, a federal public defender named Roger Peavin, was a raging alcoholic who at the time was being sued by three members of his own legal staff for various acts of drunken misconduct. Steele's second defense attorney, a man named Robert McAllister, on whom he and his wife Cindy expended most of their life savings, turned out to be facing disbarment for embezzling his client's money and was in fact disbarred only weeks after Steele's conviction. Many suspect that this second attorney may have struck a deal with the government to keep himself out of prison by deliberately taking a dive in the courtroom and bungling Steele's defense. If so, it didn't work. In September of 2012, the 62-year-old McAllister was sentenced to 6 years in jail, so there is some comfort in hoping that the bent brief may die in the same prison cell as the client he betrayed. For whatever reason, McAllister's performance in the courtroom was notably lackluster, to say the least, and he refused to put his client on the witness stand, which always looks very bad to a jury. Needless to say, the attorney's own perilous legal situation was never explained to either Ed or Cindy Steele while the trial was going on. As icing on the cake, I've spoken to persons present in the courtroom during the trial who told me that Ed Steele, quote-unquote, looked like a zombie, confused and disoriented, and he seemed completely incoherent and disconnected from what was going on around him. The consensus of opinion was that Steele was drugged on orders from someone in the federal government to make sure that he was incapable of assisting in his own defense or even understanding what was happening to him. No one knows for sure why the federal government of the United States did this horrible thing to Edgar Steele. He must have pissed somebody off really bad. I have this horrible suspicion that the whole ghastly business may simply have been some kind of grotesque experiment on the part of the FBI, just to see how far they could go and how much they could get away with in arresting and destroying critics of the regime. Edgar Steele is being held in the Victorville facility, which is well known throughout the federal system as a kind of toilet where human beings are flushed away. Among other things, the water supply in the prison is known to be contaminated with carcinogens and toxic waste, which facilitates the decline in health of those federal prisoners whom the government wishes to hear no more of. Victorville is notorious as an end-of-the-line destination. Once the gates clang shut there, no one leaves except in a body bag. Edgar Steele has been sent there to die. I'm now going to play for you the second part of Edgar Steele's prison interview with KXLY-TV in Idaho from November the 3rd, 2011, the last time Steele was allowed to be seen or heard in public before he disappeared into the belly of the beast.
What makes you so important to them that they would do this?
I've asked that question myself repeatedly. I didn't think I was very important. But they've been taking out the leaders of what we call the movement in America for years. And they're almost all gone. Gone to prison or dead. And now they're down to the second tier guys, and I'm one of those guys. I do write. I'm very opinionated. I give good reasons for the beliefs that I state. I actually have an impact on people. With my writing, I can convince people. I have a knack for that. I should have represented myself at trial, is what I should have done. I think I'd be a free man today if I had. Why would they come after me? They go after people all the time. You just don't believe it. You think, my government wouldn't do that. My government wouldn't hurt my fellow citizens. Wrong.
But why the timing? Why now? Why not at the height of the civil trial? Why not, you know, immediately after the Butler case? Why now, do you think?
It would have been pretty obvious then. Why now? Well, since then, I've written a book called Defensive Racism that's annoyed a lot of people. Some other motives. You know, when Barack Obama was elected, I sent him a copy of my book, and I sent a copy to Eric Holder, you know, the head of the Justice Department. Holder had complained that we needed to have this dialogue in America about race. So I sent it to both of them with a note saying,
I've been trying to have this dialogue for years. Here's my book. Did I annoy them with that? Is that what started all this, perhaps? I don't know. All I know is that I am very politically incorrect, not nearly so incorrect as the people I've represented, and I've represented a lot more people than the Aryan nations in politically incorrect situations. Usually done pretty well for them, because in almost every case it's a losing situation when you walk into it. I have a following on the internet throughout the world that's pretty sizable. I know it's larger than the Spokesman Review's following. I doubt that it's larger than yours, because you get repeated from several places. UKXLY, that is. And people listen to me, and I make sense. I'm not a racist. I'm not a white supremacist. That's what I get tagged with all the time. I will confess to being a white nationalist. Come on, ask me, what's the difference?
Well, I know. So you are you a white separatist?
Yes, I am. I admit that I'm a white separatist. That's why I live in North Idaho. Most of the people who live in North Idaho are, too. They're just not honest enough to admit it.
So yeah, if you can condense your beliefs, because you're right, people do call you a racist and a white supremacist.
That's right. Because I'm willing to talk about this. Here's the thing. People live in North Idaho, and they're here for the weather. They're here for the lack of population. They're here for the good shopping. They're here for the transportation. These are all acronyms, code words for living apart from other races. I don't use those code words. I just say I prefer to have my family living someplace where the neighborhood isn't riddled with the crime that comes with Mexicans and blacks living all around you. And I don't care who gets offended by that statement right now. Facts are facts. Just check U.S. Justice Department statistics, which are kept by race. 50 times as much violent crime is committed by black people than by white people. 50 times. That's not a coincidence. Is it culture? Is it racial? I think it's both, frankly.
Is it socioeconomic, though?
Sure, some of that, too. But is the socioeconomic a result of something else? Yeah, it is. The fact is, there are differences between races. Differences don't mean superiority, though. They mean differences. Just because one race is generally more intelligent than another doesn't make it better. You know, whites have an IQ on average 10 to 15 points higher in America than American black. It's about 25 to 30 points higher than African blacks. Jews in America have IQs that on average are about 10 points higher than whites. Am I willing to ascribe superiority to Jews because of that? No. Do I feel superior to blacks because of that average disparity? Hell no. Do I feel superior to my mother, who was not the sharpest knife in the drawer, because she wasn't as smart as I am? Come on. There are far better things to judge people by. Character and deeds, for example. And that's why I advocate. There's more than one race that is clearly intellectually superior to the white race, whatever the white race is, by the way. Yeah, is Obama a white man or is he a black man? I get confused by that question, since his parents were one of each. And he's obviously real bright, isn't he? Maybe an empty suit as a president, but he's bright.
But when people hear those, I know you're not trying to make friends. That's not the purpose of this. But you're not making any friends by saying these.
That's right. I'm not. But we need to have this dialogue. Just like Eric Holder said, we need to recognize the reality. People have got to stop forcing everybody to live the same way. Forcible integration throughout the country. We used to have different states that were kind of like Europe today, where the different countries had different laws, different cultures. You know, in Europe, it's working great. Would have worked great in America, too. But that's not good enough. Everybody in America's got to be the same way now. Life comes in one size, largely dispensed through your television set tube. That ain't right. You know, if you want to be able to believe something different about God, you should be allowed to do that. If you want to go live with other people who believe the same as you do, you should be allowed to do that. If you want to be living exclusively with those people, you should be allowed to do that. I mean, otherwise, it's tantamount to the government saying, here, this guy's going to be living with your family in your home now. It's no difference. Whether it's right or wrong, you have a right to free association that's constitutionally guaranteed, if we still have a constitution, of course.
But do you regret saying these things so publicly if that's what got you here?
It depends on how this turns out. There's no way that I'm going to look back on this experience and say, like, I would have boot camp. Well, I'm glad I had that experience, but I'd never do it again. No, I'm not glad I've had this experience. The toll it exacts is far greater than the lessons that it imparts. But I can certainly see how things could result from my case that I can end up being very proud of, such as the government corruption that has been uncovered that clearly is going on, not just in my case, but is going on in so many federal detainee cases throughout America. This needs to change. It needs to stop. And if my case results in that, I'll have to tell you that I'm sorry I was the one, but I'm sure glad we got that result.
I'm just looking at the sentencing memorandum from the government that they're, I mean, you're going to be sentenced in 2 weeks.
Yes.
If my math is right. It says, the facts show a person who manipulated, coerced, and intimidated others to do what he wanted done. The facts show a man was desperate with self-pity, beset by his physical ailments. His marriage was not fulfilling. That's what they say your motive is here.
Yeah, conjecture. Pure conjecture. Unfulfilling marriage. Where's the proof of that? My wife and I love each other. We have for 27 years. She stood by me through this. What does that say about our relationship? You got to ask yourself, she's privy to every bit of evidence in this case. And even though we were prevented from talking to each other, she decided almost immediately that it was a put-up job. I mean, how many women are going to do that and then stand by me the way that she has?
You think so? I mean, I'm going to just play devil's advocate. Do you think some of, like, I think if somebody came and told me my husband was trying to have me killed, I would say, no way. He would never do that. And then there's an embarrassment factor. I wouldn't want people, you know, I would say, no, it must be somebody else. No way he would want me dead.
Well, so you'd want your husband to be released so that he could actually kill you, huh? No, that's not what happened in this case. I think initially she was willing to believe them. I mean, she's like any American. My government wouldn't. This is the FBI. They wouldn't do this. I see them on TV all the time. They're the good guys. Wrong.
You're facing more time for the witness tampering, or the victim tampering, whatever it is, than you are for the murder for hire, the explosives.
Well, that's not true, but I'm... I'm facing a ridiculous amount of time on each of the charges. If they have their way, they're going to give me 60 years. I'll get out when I'm what? 125, I guess. 126.
They have the recording of you saying you need to stand like a rhinoceros and tell them that it's not.
That's right. And I said that. And there's no question that is me on the recording. But I wasn't telling her to lie. I was telling her to be resolute. I know how this goes, and I know how the FBI intimidates people, just like it tried to intimidate my wife into taking up their party line. But she's got a mind of her own, and she stood her ground like a rhinoceros in the road. I wasn't telling her to lie. I was telling her to tell the truth. There's no way I could get her to lie, and she knows that, and I know that.
You never wanted to kill your wife, never tried to kill your wife?
Absolutely not.
I'm just trying to make sure I'm going in the right direction here with moving this forward. But are you...
We're going to talk about the government corruption, right?
Well, oh, yeah.
I keep dropping that hint on
you. No, I totally agree. And I want to make sure we cover every fact of this case
right.
First, for sure.
Sure.
You know, a jury, it didn't take them that long to convict you.
Couple of days, not that long, that's right.
Especially with as complicated as the federal jury instructions can sometimes be.
This was very simple because nobody fought to have any instructions put in that helped my case at all.
I like that you said that you should have represented yourself. Why didn't you?
Because I've sat through trials with the accused next to me many times. It's not an unfamiliar situation to me. And I got to tell you, just shifting from that seat to this seat makes all the difference in the world. And for the first time in my life, I realize why you really have lawyers. I couldn't trust myself. I couldn't trust my point of view. I still feel like Alice gone through the looking glass. I can't, even though I have investigated, I've seen it in case after case, how the government has fabricated evidence and done wrong things that I want to tell you about in this case, that we're telling the U.S. Supreme Court about just today with a filing, by the way, that I couldn't believe what was going on in my case. Is this really going on, or is it just because I'm in the hot seat this time? Other lawyers have told me they've never seen anything like this, so there is something going on.
I'm still attempting to determine when was the last time anyone physically heard from Edgar J. Steele, either by phone, by letter, or by email. The official Edgar Steele website hasn't been updated for almost a month, and in any case contains no recent information regarding Ed's well-being, no letters or communications from him, and no indication that he's responding to anyone. Now, I have heard some things which would account for this, and which I hasten to add reflect no discredit against anyone on our side, and a lot of discredit on the Federal Bureau of Investigation. There is information to the effect that some genuinely vile pressure is being brought on Cindy Steele, vile even by FBI standards. However, since I am unable to obtain any confirmation from anyone close to the family that these things are in fact happening, I won't mention them. Okay, moving along. A while back, I played the first Moog synthesizer single to hit the charts from 1969, a cut called The Minotaur. After that, a lot of Moog and electronic music bands came along, including a German outfit called Tangerine Dream, which was founded in 1967 and is still in existence, with only one original band member remaining. A Tangerine Dream inspired a lot of electronic and synthesizer bands down through the years, including Mannheim Steamroller, I believe. In 1976, they produced the entire soundtrack to a very strange movie called The Sorcerer, which had nothing whatsoever to do with Harry Potter or anything like that, but it was about a handful of misfits working for a diamond mine in South America, having to manhandle a rickety old truck full of nitroglycerin through the jungle to the mine. I'm going to play the theme from that movie for you now, and it's going to sound a little Halloween-y, like in the John Carpenter movie, but that's not the intention. Don't worry, we'll have our annual Halloween show featuring ghostly music 2 weeks from tonight on October the 25th. But now, just for something a bit different, here's Tangerine Dream. Thank you.
comrades. Tonight I would like to tell you about a book written by an author by the name of Tilak. This is a book by an Indian author who knew Mahatma Gandhi, and he was also interested in the Indian independence movement. This author is a scholar that is very interested in Vedic text, and through the study of Vedic text and also Avestrian texts, he wants to determine the original homeland of the Aryans. In his study of the Rig Veda, he finds that there are these hymns. There are 30 hymns to the dawn, and there are 100 hymns that are to be sung during the evening. And so he decides from this that this is a reflection of an Arctic homeland. In order to make this argument, he takes from the Avestian, which is a Zoroastrian Iranian mythology, and also from the Vedas, and to a lesser degree from Western European mythologies. And he finds that there is always this struggle between light and the dark. And especially in the case of looking at Vedic and Avestian hymns and mythological stories, he finds that there is a great anxiety about the darkness and the light. And instead of the usual interpretation that this is merely the daily cycles of light and dark, or even the vernal cycles, or anxiety about, for example, weather, he believes that these hymns are written because of an Arctic homeland where there was actually a month of dawns and at least 100 day darkness. Now, he says that the summer season in this Arctic homeland would have lasted anywhere from 10 to 7 months based on where you lived in terms of your latitude. He says that the dark time was considered very inauspicious. It was considered a time when Indra was battling with the demons of darkness, and this dark time was considered a very inauspicious time to die. In the Avastic text, someone who dies during the dark period of the year really cannot be buried until the spring comes. And he says that the Avastic text would never have a rule like this if there was any daylight during the winter season. And I think that this is a compelling argument. And he talks about how the ancients would watch the movements of the stars, and he talks about how they would describe the various seeming movements of various stars, and he says that the way they described it is very much how it would appear to a viewer in the Arctic. And he also talks about the Arctic mindset, and he says that in the ancient mindset, that there was really no difference between sunlight and the movement of water, and the clouds and the filament of the heavens. The sun was conceived of going into a dark netherworld and being shrouded in darkness when they couldn't see the sun. It was conceived as, in a sense, fighting with these demons of darkness and then reemerging triumphantly. These various hymns that they would sing would assist the sun in its triumphs. And so the priests really were essential to keeping the universal order in the ancient mind. He talks about these legends of floods and how there have always been these stories, and I don't think that's the most pervasive argument or persuasive argument, because of course I know there's always been floods. But when you take all of these stories together, he does make a convincing story for an Arctic home. And he believes that this Arctic home was above Siberia, because he says, and I believe he's quite right in the point, that the Avastic text and the Vedic text preserved more of the original culture and religion than did any of the European stories. So he relies heavily on the eastern branches to fill in ancient history. And he's really quite enthused about the Arctic homeland, and he says that other races may have also come from there. But he says that's really not the essence of his investigation, because he's mainly interested in deciding on the location of an Aryan homeland in the ancient times. He says that this homeland was made when the Arctic became too cold to inhabit. I would really recommend this book because it's a very unique theory. I've never come across anything quite like it, and I would say that he makes a very substantive argument. Now, I can't say that this is necessarily correct because I don't have any archaeological evidence to really back up his ideas. So in that sense, I find them rather fanciful. However, I would still recommend his book. So I hope you enjoyed my review, and thank you for listening.
During the first year of this podcast, before I got into the panel discussions, I regularly ran audio from our white nationalist movement's past, speeches by such people as Huey Long, Father Coughlin, Gerald L.K. Smith, George Lincoln Rockwell, William Pierce, Louis Beam, so forth and so on. It never ceases to shock me just how little we in the movement today know about our own past. And I'm going to play an interesting bit of audio that one of our comrades forwarded to me. It's from the early 1960s, not sure of the exact date, when there was only one Ku Klux Klan, which was the United Klans of America, or UKA, headed by Robert Shelton. And so it's from the days before MP3 files or digital recordings, and even before cassette tapes, for that matter. This is a segment from a 48-minute, 33 RPM vinyl recording that was put out by the UKA. And the voice is that of Wally Butterworth, who was at one point a well-known American radio announcer and TV personality, and the host of a variety of quiz shows. Yes, believe it or not, there was a time when actual celebrities and people of stature in the community supported white nationalism. Well, this is completely dated, of course, and the racial rhetoric will sound very quaint to modern ears, but I suppose there's still a few old farts like me around who remember the UKA and remember those days and what we were like.
The purpose of this recording is to tell the American people the truthful meaning of the noble Christian fraternal order, the Knights of the Ku Klux Klan, and to tell you why you, if you can qualify, should become a Klansman or Klanswoman. The Ku Klux Klan is a secret religious order, but it is not a clandestine organization, and it never has been. It is the prayer of every Klansman that it will not again have to become an avenging organization. But if our courts, our Congress, and our President continue to oppress the white Caucasian race, denying us those God-given rights which are not government-given rights, then we shall once again avenge these tyrannies and prove worthy of our Protestant Christian ancestors. Look at history for a moment. In 1865, the Garden of the South was turned into a desert by General Sherman's army. 10,000 homes and plantations were burned to the ground. Confederate money was worthless. Poverty was everywhere, but a brave people decided to weather the storm. It isn't taught in our schools, but every historian now knows that the Civil War was not fought over slavery of the Negro. It was fought and planned by European Jewish bankers in London, England, the Rothschilds, in fact, to gain the manufacture and control of American money, which they have to this day under the Federal Reserve banking system. Slavery was only the political excuse. Not only had most of the southern state legislatures passed resolutions condemning slavery, but hundreds of the largest slave owners had freed their slaves, even going back to Thomas Jefferson. Judah Benjamin, the second in command in the Confederacy, was an agent of the Rothschilds, as was J.P. Morgan in the North and later Jacob Schiff, and before the both of them, Alexander Hamilton, whose real name was Levin. He was the illegitimate son of a Jew who started the first bank of the United States, which was later broken up. Abraham Lincoln refused to pay these Jews the interest to finance the war. The $400 billion he printed on the credit of the American people is the only money in this country upon which we pay no interest. When Lincoln planned to ship the freed slaves back to Africa and remove the cause of the trouble, he was assassinated by these Jews. And the blame for his assassination was easily placed upon the South. Lincoln's whole plan is now proven history. There were no prisoners of war when General Lee surrendered. The war, terrible and bloody as it was fought by honorable men in both blue and gray uniforms. 2 years after the war was over in 1867, Thaddeus Stevens, who certainly must be considered the vilest American who ever lived, gained control of the Congress. He refused to seat the elected senators and representatives the South had sent back to Washington, and he placed former Negro slaves in their places. This club-footed, warped-minded creature was the disgrace of the North. His mulatto mistress was the first lady of the land in Washington. Both of them are buried in a common grave today in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. Every white man who had fought for the Confederacy was disfranchised. Only illiterate black slaves who couldn't read or write were allowed to vote. Every state legislature, every court of law, and all police authority lay in the hands of niggers and white scallywags. In South Carolina alone, the treasury was looted by these people of over $50 million. A tax of $50 a bale was placed on cotton, which robbed the impoverished South of another $67 million. The foreclosure of homes for taxes took away three-quarters of the white man's land. And then came the arming of these completely uneducated black men, not only armed with guns, but with liquor. Overnight, imprisonment of white men and women without trial took place, and finally came the rape of fair white women by their former slaves. The bravest Southern men, led by all of the clergymen of that day, went to see General Lee. Contrast that with the traitor clergy we have today in all denominations. General Lee, too, knew that our government had broken faith and sent 500,000 federal troops plus 200,000 drunken armed niggers here to the South. General Lee told these men that he had pledged his honor and was on parole. He told them to go and see General Nathan Bedford Forrest, that whatever movement they adopted would have to be underground and operate in greatest secrecy. It was General Lee who suggested the name the Invisible Empire. Thus was born in Pulaski, Tennessee, the Invisible Empire of the Ku Klux Klan. It was taken strictly from the ancient tribal clans of Scotland whose descendants had settled the southern states. No cross of Jesus Christ was ever desecrated by that first clan, nor by any clan ever since. Yet renegade journalists like Julian Harris, the son of Joel Chandler Harris of Uncle Remus fame, won a Pulitzer Prize by inferring that niggers were burned on the fiery cross of the clan. And subversive traitors today like Ralph McGill, Rastus McGill, continue the smear. But within a year, the Negro was completely disarmed. Troublemakers, both white and black, were invited to leave the South, and they left, even mayors and military officials. The ravishers of white women, both white and black, were hanged without mercy. All were flogged for lesser offenses. The Klan restored law and order to the nation, and within 2 years, General Forrest ordered them disbanded. The history of the Ku Klux Klan is unparalleled. A people who were helplessly ground in the dust of defeat rose within 2 years to complete victory. The Klan did more than save the virtue and purity of Southern white womanhood. It saved the honor of the then disgraceful United States government. Why do you suppose it is that no meeting of Klansmen or Klanswomen can ever be opened until the sacred altar is prepared on which rests the Holy Bible? And only after the fiery cross is illuminated.
I was playing back the first part of this show, and I was thinking about this possible switch to Romney by the establishment, as indicated in the polls and whatnot, and I think it's possible that I may be doing something which it seems to me I warned you guys about as recently as last week, so I need to remind myself of my own advice and to repeat it to you as well, because this is something we all really need to wrap our minds around. Our very survival as a species may well depend on a clear understanding on our part of exactly who we're dealing with. Now, it's a very easy thing to do, but we mustn't fall into the trap of thinking of the enemy as a monolith, as some kind of gigantic single conspiracy controlled by a secret cabal of rabbis and international bankers who gather at some luxury hotel for the Bilderberg Conference once a year and plot to destroy Western civilization, Christianity, and the white race. Now, there are some elements of that kind of behavior true, as with the Bilderbergers and the Council on Foreign Relations, etc., but the big picture is much more nuanced and complex than that, and it is not all Jewish by any means. The Jews are only one part of an overall sociographic trend, I guess you'd call it, that goes back to the late 18th century and which is known as the Enlightenment. Now, that's not necessarily the same thing as the Illuminati you've heard about, and although this is going to get me into all kinds of trouble with our conspiracy theorists, I'm not certain that Adam Weishaupt's little club did in fact survive too much longer than about 10 years before the secret police of Bavaria and some other German states broke it up. But the Enlightenment, as opposed to the Illuminati, most certainly did survive and prevail. And its first fruits were the French Revolution, wherein the first ideological dictator of history, a lawyer named Maximilien Robespierre, slaughtered hundreds of thousands of people, not just with the guillotine. The guillotine was actually pretty low-tech by today's standards, and they figure only about 20,000 people were murdered that way. But through pointless war, economic incompetence and corruption, and deliberate starvation used as a weapon. In other words, all the kind of crap that we've come to associate with leftist and liberal rule from the time of Lenin to the time of Obama. Anyway, I'm starting to ramble, but I think we need to be cautious about seeing conspiracies under the bed, and that means me as well. This recent Romney surge may just mean that too many people did see Obama screw up in the debate, and they realized that without his teleprompter, he's just a stupid nigger. And we were talking last week about how it might happen, and one way, of course, is that the regime and their muscle men from the police and the FBI and the alphabet soup agencies may just plain lose control. And all those spy cameras on every corner and the drones in the sky and the facial recognition software and the naked body scanners and the groping TSA agents and the whole surveillance state that they're trying to set up may just fall apart, be no good to them at all, because nobody in the United States government is competent enough to maintain such a thing. Well, let's hope. Okay, third music break. Now, this is a murder ballad, and I actually might have saved this for Halloween, except it's in an incomprehensible Scots dialect that none of you will be able to understand, so I need to translate. It's called Lady Daisy, who is a princess who's been getting it on with the help. She gets pregnant and has an illegitimate baby, which in the 15th century was a no-no for anybody, but especially for royals. The king comes to her room and demands to know who the father of the child is, and she breaks down and tells him that it's a lad named Roger who works in the kitchen, kind of a medieval dishwasher or busboy or something, which, of course, sends Daddy-O into orbit. He goes down to the kitchen, he cuts off Roger's head, puts it in a colander or something, and sends it up to Daisy's room as his comment on her taste in boyfriends. And so Lady Daisy then makes a long speech about the course of true love never running smoothly, blah, blah, blah. And she picks up the baby and jumps out the window, either onto the ocean rocks below or a courtyard. That's not made clear in the song, but in any case, Daisy and the baby both go splat. Sounds kind of like the National Enquirer or TMZ.com, doesn't it? Well, people back then liked sex and sleaze and blood and gore just like they do today, except that back then they didn't have supermarket checkout lines to read tabloids in. This is the Tannehill Weavers.
And the king, oh, mortal thing, he had the lovely Dr. B. Lady Daisy was her name. And what's gain up and what's gain down? And what's gone to the king? Lady Daisy, she gone dressed round about, and to whom they turn again. When bells were rung and mass was sung, and a bard gone to the rest, the king's gone to Lady Daisy's bower, and he was near a welcome guest. He's pulled the curtain round about, and there he sat him down. He tell me, Lady Daisy, he said, what God you can see room? Is it to your law, or to your lips, or a bar and no hide it be? He tell me, Lady Daisy, he said, and I pray eternally. Oh, it's no tail, Lord, and it's no tail there, nothing on the barony. But it's the Roger, the kitchen boy, for cause the hiding me. As many men hurt by one, by two, by three. And last came Roger, the kitchen boy, and he's dashed him to a tree. And he's taken out that bonny boy's hat, put it in a cup of gold. He sent it to Lady Daisy's bar, because she's been so bold. Farewell, fair, farewell, mother, farewell to comfort and joy. He died for me, I'll die for him, though he was but a kitchen boy. Farewell, mother, farewell, fair, farewell, my brother's dream. He thought she had taken the life of him, but she'd taken the life of me.
Okay, we're starting to run a bit long, and I haven't really thought of a final rant as such, so I'll take a couple emails. A number of people, a surprising number in fact, have asked me who I recommend that they vote for on November the 6th, who I intend to vote for, etc. Well, I confess I yielded and voted for McCain in 2008 just as an act of symbolic protest against the immaculation of the one, but I'm not going to bother to vote this time around because Romney is such a complete Israel lackey, and also because with a neocon like that, I'd very likely be voting for the same man who signs the order for my arrest without trial and sends me off somewhere to be tortured or murdered. Because you understand that if Romney gets hold of the White House, he's still going to have that National Defense Authorization Act of 2011 that was passed by Obama, right? Now, as for voting for Obama as some kind of joke or worse is better dumbass mess, no. Under no circumstances whatsoever will I ever vote for anything I should be throwing peanuts to in a cage. My sense of humor may be a bit epicene at times, but that's not funny. Look, if you want to vote for Romney just to try and help clean the monkey shit out of the Oval Office, that's fine by me. What you might want to do is vote in the congressional races for any Tea Party candidates just to try and make Arianna Huffington and Michael Moore scream and scream. I got another email of a kind that I get about every 6 weeks or so. Dear Harold, why are you never specific about your plans to bring about the Northwest American Republic? You need to spell out for us exactly what you need and what you want us to do. Okay, I will do this, comrade, the courtesy of assuming that he's new and he hasn't had a chance to download the 141 previous podcasts wherein I repeatedly tell people what I want them to do and what I need, so we'll give it another shot. I want you to come here and help me. That is the main thing I need. Nobody can do anything without boots on the ground. And yes, I do mean you. Then, beyond that, I need massive amounts of money so that I can buy the goods and services and assistance that the entire white race should be giving me freely and voluntarily. Now, it shouldn't be that way, but it is. This is 2012, not 1912. White people who will do things simply because they are right have become almost completely extinct. I need the rest of you to come here and help me so that I can locate, identify, educate, and motivate that tiny number of exceptions among our people who still carry the old alpha gene. You, as an individual, may not be a Northwest volunteer now or ever. But if not, you need to help me find those who can and will be. And right now, that pretty much sums it up, at least insofar as anything I can or will say with our friends in the silk suits listening. Well, our time is up, and so that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington 98104, or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sasha Andaban. Freedom.